Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back guest co-host, Laurel Sisler.
Thank you.
We recently had a conversation that we're going to hear today with Associate Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences at the University of North Carolina's Allied Health, Dr. Adam Jacks, about aphasia and how communication literally breaks down for some patients. First, though, we're going to talk about some research that matters that we hope will be helpful. Let's talk first about a new discovery, really kind of exciting, for people who sometimes die of sudden death in young people, a gene in their family that could be responsible for a key protein, and this deficiency could lead to the abnormalities causing sudden death.
Yeah, so it's this gene called CDH2, and they found that a mutation in this gene has been shown to cause this sudden cardiac death in young people. So really exciting discovery, I think, mostly because they think that they can now maybe do something to prevent it.
Right. So if you have this deficiency, you could be tested for it, and then they may be able to at least do some interventions and some risk monitoring, because what happens is when this gene is not there, you develop kind of excess fatty tissue, fibrous tissue in the heart muscle itself, which predisposes to these arrhythmias, these cardiomyopathies. And we have heard about people who die suddenly at young ages. And these are such tragedies, and perhaps they run in the family. And this was published in the journal Circulation and Cardiovascular Genetics. What do you think is going to be one of the implications of this?
I'm not totally sure, but I think that one thing they talk about, too, is for family members who have had this happen, that then their family members could get tested as well. So, you know, hopefully you would not have to have two tragedies in the same family.
They're going to check to see and try to prevent the buildup of these proteins that really normally cause these cells to stay together. Yeah, talk with your doctor. Talk with a geneticist. Find out. This is starting to hopefully move into prime time. I would hope that there are thousands of deaths a year that we may start to really impact on that we couldn't do before. Very exciting research. Our next research that matters is actually also interesting, maybe complex, but it has to do with hormone replacement therapy and mortality for women. You probably have heard among relatives or patients see them that they're taking hormone replacement therapy, right, Laurel?
Yes. I kind of got whiplash reading this because I feel like that you often have that experience when you're reading about hormone replacement therapy. Research has shown many benefits, but also some risks, including the thing I think of a lot is breast cancer, which I think is a legitimate risk in some populations. But this particular study is talking about how women who were on hormone replacement therapy was actually associated with having a lower risk of early mortality, and they link that specifically to cardiovascular risks.
So the overall mortality would suggest, and particularly like you said, Laurel, maybe through much lower cardiovascular risk, maybe having to do with impacts of the estrogen on the cholesterol, some favorable impacts, that it could lead to an overall benefit here. And they did what might be called an observational study to look at these associations between women who received hormone therapy over a long period of time and these effects on death. They did find that a lot less people were on hormone replacement therapy more recently than in the past, I guess maybe because of the exact reason you're talking about.
Yeah.
And this was a report in the American College of Cardiology's annual scientific session. And I think it does make me a little bit dizzy. You feel like you're on a roller coaster.
Yeah.
But perhaps you're at least on the roller coaster. And perhaps this is a conversation. If you had a family history strongly for cardiovascular disease and you had a very low family history of breast cancer, it may
that
well
might be an
that
option.
Might tip the option here, and yeah. certainly talk with your doctor about this research study. Let's talk about the next research study. We're going from one extreme to the other, something that perhaps is makes one a little dizzy thinking about, to something that's like a duh, this has got to be good. What are we talking about here, Laurel?
Well, it's a duh, but it's not, doesn't seem to be happening in our public policy. It's an article talking about how raising the minimum wage could really reduce teen pregnancies substantially, showing that just a dollar increase in the minimum wage would likely reduce the U.S. teen birth rate by about 2%, which for anybody who's working in that field or in public health in general, 2% reduction in teen pregnancy is huge.
About 5,000 fewer births a year to teens. And these are not planned pregnancies. Apparently, this higher minimum wage is more likely to keep teens working and delay childbearing. This was in the American Journal of Public Health. We've known that increasing minimum wage has some other health benefits in general for the population, right?
Yeah, living longer, lower BMI or body mass index, less likely to abuse children as well.
It just makes you wonder sometimes. This is not a Democratic or Republican issue, I think. I think this really is a public health issue, and perhaps we've done a mistake in terms of framing elevated minimum wages, which has great benefits. But I think as healthcare providers, we can argue for it for public health benefits. This seems pretty profound. And if you raise it for more than that, you're probably going to have a win-win for the teen, for the provider, and for the population.
And it makes me think about our recent repeal of HB2 as well, that threw in an ordinance in there about preventing local governments from increasing the minimum wage. So some real impact.
The House bill, too, that for our listeners around the country, the North Carolina repealed, to much to the great happiness of many people in the state. Our last research that matters has to do with volunteering, something I think that's probably something near and dear to you, myself, and most of the people I know.
Yeah, a study showing that actually people who volunteer are significantly healthier than those who do not volunteer.
And we're talking about volunteering at maybe nonprofits, volunteering at the hospital,
giving blood, things like that.
Anything that takes you perhaps outside of what you would normally do in your paid work environment and brings you in touch with other people.
Yeah, and the gains were about that of taking 5 years, like being 5 years younger. So pretty significant health gains.
Yeah, this was research that was looking at volunteering, employment, and health data in more than 40,000 European citizens in a whole variety of countries. This is across Europe. It was published in the journal PLOS 1+1, and it is not only with better health outcomes, it's with actually better employment. And so they controlled for lots of different variables. Higher income is certainly associated with the better employment, has better health, but yet it also, the better health outcomes are also linked to better employment opportunities that it seems like the volunteering is associated with.
Yeah, they're suggesting that might be the mechanism. Kind of volunteering leads to more employment opportunities, more economic opportunities.
And it not only does increase physical, it seems to increase cognitive, our thinking activity, which does protect against dementia. Well, that'll conclude the Research Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to hear our interview with the Associate Professor of Speech and Hearing at the University of North Carolina, Dr. Adam Jacks, about aphasia and how communication literally breaks down for some patients. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Associate Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences at the University of North Carolina's Allied Health Department, Dr. Adam Jacks, about aphasia and how communication can literally break down for patients. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Jacks.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You know, we're really thrilled to have you here because I think this is one of those topics when we say aphasia that people may not know much about. But before we jump in and find out exactly what that is, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in speech disorders?
That's a great question. I was interested in the brain as a high schooler. I would read some of these articles about learning about which of the different areas of the brain were involved with language. I was interested in language myself. As an undergraduate student, I saw a flyer one day about, are you interested in how the brain creates language? And there was this advanced seminar on psycholinguistics. And I went to see the professor and she said, well, you really need to take some cognitive psychology, and started learning about different things that can happen to the brain and how language is impacted. And then I found this profession. I thought, you know, there's got to be a profession where these people who lose the ability to talk after a brain injury can get help. And so that's how I found this field.
Yeah, you were at the other great institution other than the University of North Carolina. You were at Duke University.
That's right, as an undergraduate.
As a great research institute. And then you were in Austin pursuing a master's and a PhD. So we should start defining terms here, because this is one of those areas that I think it's intuitively easy to hear it, but we wouldn't know what exactly it means. So when we say apraxia or aphasia, what are we talking about? What's the difference and why is it important?
Great question. So aphasia is typically a kind of a broader classification. I think that, you know, literally from the Greek, it means without speech or speechless. Usually we kind of differentiate and say it's a language loss caused by a brain injury. And most of the folks that I see who have aphasia are stroke survivors. But they, you know, people can have aphasia because of a traumatic brain injury or even from a focal degenerative illness as well. So apraxia of speech is a little bit different. We think that it really, the language itself is fine. People know the words they want to say. They may have the ability to read and write perfectly well, but they have difficulty programming the movements of speech, putting their tongue in the right place at the correct time, and all the different speech articulators. So lips, tongues, soft palate, all of them have to be orchestrated rather precisely. We don't even know that we're doing it really. And so people who have apraxia of speech typically have lost the ability to program some of those learned movements.
And that would be very different than someone who, for instance, has severe stuttering of speech. Help us understand, is this a continuum of some sort?
That's a great question too. There are some similarities between stuttering and apraxia of speech. Typically, people who stutter as a child, they begin stuttering as a 3 or 4 year old, and many people stutter as a child and then they gradually recover from it. They learn strategies to not stutter. They just become more fluent. Some kids just outgrow it. Apraxia of speech, I would say it has more to do with the initial programming of the movements, putting the speech movements into the sequences to make certain sounds. Whereas in stuttering, and we don't know the exact cause of stuttering, but that a lot of researchers think that maybe it has something to do with integrating feedback from the speech that somebody has produced.
So when I think aphasia, I unfortunately remembered, and a lot of times as a doctor, the things that you've seen that are difficult. And I remember seeing an emergency room, two decades ago, someone who came in, a young person, really in their early 30s, who had a severe stroke. And the neurologist told me they had developed a condition called locked in, which I had never seen it before. And it was terrifying that here was someone who could hear and understand everything, mm-hmm. but couldn't talk. And is that a type of aphasia?
I would call locked-in syndrome, I think in its purest form, it's a pure motor difficulty. And so it can happen in people with advanced ALS, for example.
Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis,
that's right.
The Lou Gehrig's disease.
Exactly. And so if their language may be perfectly intact so that everything they hear or listen to, they can understand it perfectly well. You know, if they were able to move their hand, they could write perfectly well. They could form those words. But it's a loss of the neuromuscular ability in most people with locked-in syndrome. So people with aphasia frequently will have difficulty talking. They may have some motor difficulty, but it's really a loss of the words or the language abilities. And so that could be they may have difficulty reading, they may have difficulty writing, speaking, or sometimes even listening. Their cognitive abilities are intact, but they have difficulties processing the words that they hear. So it may be some people with aphasia, if you were to speak with me or talk to me, I might feel like you're speaking a foreign language. You know, I've had people sitting across from me and they would say, we'd say, okay, say the word phone. Or you would show them a phone and say, okay, say that word or have them repeat it or something like that. And they said, I know you want me to do something, but I'm just not hearing you. It all sounds like noise. So there's a lot of different ways that aphasia can manifest. Most classically, I think it's in the difficulty finding words, in expressing yourself verbally.
So someone who's had a stroke, for instance, may know that they're trying to find the word, but they can't say the word.
Yeah.
And that's got to be incredibly frustrating versus someone perhaps with dementia may not be able to say the word correct, but maybe they don't know that they can't say the word. Is this part of the spectrum?
And I mean, I think that there are similarities. Some people with dementia do develop aphasia. I'm not sure that I would put them on a spectrum because I think about it more in terms of, you know, usually people with aphasia will say to you, I know it, I just can't say it. And those will be some words that are intact in their vocabulary or phrases. I know it. I just can't say it.
So outside of stroke, what other sorts of conditions would aphasia really become part of what happens?
Well, I think the most common one on my mind is there's a type of frontotemporal dementia. And so there's something called primary progressive aphasia, where there's a degenerative process in some of the language areas, and so that the initiating symptom is language only. And so there's no difficulty with memory necessarily, but maybe their speech slows down a little bit. Maybe they have difficulty making the right sounds. And so that's one that's become progressively more recognized locally, especially.
And what about Parkinson's? Is aphasia ever a part of Parkinson's?
It can be. Typically, Parkinson's disease is more a motor disorder. And so the same kind of motor problems that affect walking in people with Parkinson's disease or writing, these small movements, that can also affect speech. Most of the time, language is relatively intact. And so if they could make their speech articulators move appropriately, their speech would be, you know, the actual message that they were sending would be perfectly intelligible.
Well, we're trying to make sense out of something that's really complicated, and I really appreciate we're talking with our guest, Dr. Adam Jacks, Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina in Allied Health Sciences. We're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about how do we treat it? What's the research say? What do we know? What do we need more research in? And lots of really interesting things. We'll be right back with your health, Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. And we've been talking with Associate Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences at University of North Carolina's Allied Health Program, Dr. Adam Jacks, about aphasia and how communication literally breaks down for some patients. Dr. Jacks, take us through any of the cases that you were talking about. Someone who has developed aphasia, and what's it like, and how does that impact their life?
It affects people almost in every dimension of their life. And so, you know, I can think of some of my friends with aphasia. Most of the people that I know with aphasia these days are many years past their stroke or brain injury. But they'll tell me about, you know, when I was in the hospital, I couldn't say a word. And I was so frustrated. I couldn't talk to my spouse. I couldn't talk to my doctors. I couldn't talk to the nurses. If I rang the bell to go to the bathroom, you know, they would come and I might not be able to talk to them. So that's in the very early stages. Typically, as a person goes through the days and weeks after a stroke, their language may recover fairly rapidly due to spontaneous processes of recovery, reduction in swelling in the areas of brain that have been affected. After a few weeks and months, the recovery slows down somewhat, or it may slow down, but people continue to get better. And frankly, I've seen people continue to improve for months, years, even decades after their injury. But a lot of times people may be left with some level of residual impairment of different abilities. And everybody's a little bit different in how they're impacted. But some people lose spouses. Some people lose their jobs and are unable to go back to the kind of work that they did before.
Well, one of the things I think about is like a patient of mine, when they, after a stroke, they come in to see me and they're having great difficulty getting the words out. Well, the medical exam room, the medical encounter is built around a 20-minute visit.
Yes.
And yet it may take twice as long. And, my initial reaction is, I just need to just sit here for a while. I can't be rushing. But do I try to find a word for them, or do I just be patient and let that happen? What do you recommend? Because this would be true for friends and family members, mm-hmm. how to understand and work.
Oh, I'm really happy you asked that question, because I think that, it's natural to want to help somebody when they're having trouble finding their word and you think you know what they want to say. It may be natural to want to kind of jump in and say, oh, you're thinking this or you're saying this. Most of the time, it's best to let somebody finish themselves. And it does take longer, and it doesn't lend itself well to the 20-minute office visit. I think an analogy that I like to use is, so somebody who's visually impaired, if they're crossing a street and you don't know them, the thing not to do would be to grab their arm, but would be for them, if they want help, say, can I take your arm as we cross the street? And I think the same thing is true with aphasia. Sometimes I will ask a person, if it's clear they're having a hard time and if it seems clear to me that they're not going to get it out, I say, can I ask you if you're talking about this? Can I ask if you're referring to this apple that you're trying to get to eat? Or are you trying to refer to this person? Are you talking about your wife? But it's more letting them give you permission to do that.
You're asking a question rather than suggesting a statement.
Yeah, exactly.
So let me ask you a question, because mm-hmm. you told us earlier how you were just excited
yeah.
about the brain. And I know that you are really interested in neuroscience. What's happening up in the brain? And you do really interesting research on things like script training. You're mm-hmm. dissertation was on this vowel acoustics. How does this play in with your understanding and what's happening?
Great question. And I think that we're still finding out really how the brain works in somebody with aphasia, how best to help somebody to recover based on what we know about the brain. We do think that there is some modularity in the brain where different areas are somewhat specialized for different activities. We think that in the frontal areas of the left hemisphere, more involved with planning the movements of speech, whereas the more posterior temporal parts of the brain might be more involved in feedback, sensory feedback, or understanding of language. But they all have to work together. So it's really hard to know in a person who's had a stroke and they've lost part of their, some cells in their brain, and that's impacting their communication. And I think we don't really know yet what is the person who's recovered really well, how are they using their brain to create language? So I think, one possibility and one thing that, there are scientists working on is studying the areas near lesions. So if you have a large lesion in the left frontal lobe, it may be that areas around that lesion, spared tissue near there, is taking over for the areas that have been damaged. There's some thought, I think, about the right hemisphere. So language is typically thought to be kind of a left hemisphere ability or skill. Not to say that the right hemisphere isn't involved at all, but I think that some people, some researchers have suggested that if there's a large lesion in the left hemisphere, that similar areas in the right hemisphere may try to take over to compensate for the lack of language
there. So we're going to take this from up on high right down to the level of what do we do? What do we do when we have a loved one? What are you doing in the examination room, your colleagues? What are two or three simple things, maybe they're not simple, that you do to help people with aphasia get better? Because it sounds like you do believe, and you've mentioned they can get better and do get better sometimes years later.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think, you know, the first thing that I would recommend is patience, you know, really observant listening and paying attention in general to a person. I think communication can involve many different kind of modalities. And so people with aphasia, sometimes they're able to write or they can draw pictures to supplement the words that they're able to say. So if they're not able to say every word, they may be able to say, you know, at least some of the letters. Most of the time, people with aphasia, or often I should say, will have right hemisphere, right side of the body weakness, right hemiplegia. And so they're often writing with their left hand, which is usually not their dominant hand, but it helps people get by. Sometimes people will gesture to help get their message across. For family members, I would encourage them to seek out resources in their community. We have a local nonprofit that I do a lot of research with and board service with, and they do a family and caregiver training about once a month called Learning to Speak Aphasia, and they give people strategies for how to communicate with somebody.
And are there any speech exercises that people do that will help, you know, articulate or help develop the strength, kind of like one might train a muscle to be stronger? Can you do that with your speech or no?
It is possible, yes. And, you know, depending on, you know, what the nature of the impairment is and, you know, working with the licensed speech language pathologist, they will help find out, okay, what are your different areas that are really impacted? Sometimes the, you know, the speech exercises themselves wouldn't be that helpful, but, you know, learning strategies for word finding, for example, and, you know, thinking of the word that you want to say, or the script training, I think, is a good example of training certain sets of sentences that you need when you go to order a coffee or if you want to go to a restaurant so that you can order for yourselves and, you know, not to have somebody else have to order on your behalf.
Well, I assume this translates to talking on the phone and all of the elements here. We only have about a minute or so left. I'd love to, if you could just tell us about CARD and talking about what resources are available in communities, perhaps locally, but really more importantly, how do people find out wherever they are? We have listeners around the country. How do people find out?
That's great. I think that, you know, one of the best places to go around the country, Aphasia Access is a recently created organization which is meant to connect people with aphasia and researchers and people leading community-based nonprofit organizations that serve people with aphasia. Usually they'll know who is there locally that can help you. In our community here, there's Triangle Aphasia Project Unlimited, based in Cary, provides low-cost group programming for people with aphasia. Certainly our own lab, Center for Aphasia and Related Disorders, we're always looking.
That's the CARD.
That's CARD, right? at aphasia.unc.edu, and we are always looking to find out who is there in the community living with aphasia, and certainly we're happy to have people in our trials, our research. We're always working to try to understand aphasia better, but also to try to develop innovative treatments that help people living with aphasia.
Well, we want to certainly thank you, Dr. Adam Jacks, for sharing your expertise, your compassion, your knowledge. I think you've helped us all understand better something that's difficult to understand.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Associate Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences at the University of North Carolina Allied Health, Dr. Adam Jacks, about aphasia and how to prevent breakdown for patients. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laurel and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Laurel, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they just send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Well, let's ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about what happens when you get a fever.
If someone in my family gets a fever when they're sick, at what point should I worry? When is a fever too high?
I don't think, first off, any of us like fevers. And it's like that's a sign all of a sudden, you know, like you get your chills, you get your fever, get your headaches, sometimes your stomach hurts, you know you're sick.
It's a sign you're really sick, not just like the kind that you can kind of, you know, work through.
Right. You get all that stuff without the fever. You can do it. You get the fever. And, you know, one of the things we have people do is a lot of times get a thermometer. I'm not sure if anyone's ever proved having a thermometer benefits people, but you like people to check in, because I guess there's a difference between if it's like 99.5, like, oh, I'm so hot, I'm dying. And, you know, check it, it's like 99.1. It's like, oh, Adam, you know, just you're okay. You just got a little fever. And if it's like 103 and it's like, oh, my God, I am kind of sick.
Yeah, that would be a risk, I think.
I think there's some evidence that perhaps the higher the fever, the more likely you might have a bacterial infection, and it could be in your bloodstream. You get those shaking chills and you get a very high fever. Well, that's a sign sometimes of a strep infection. Those are things you want to get into the doctor. So when is it too high? I don't know. What's kind of common sense? What are the things that you as a patient would start to worry about, Laurel?
I honestly am not totally sure, but my gut instinct is like 102, 10 would be – I don't know where that comes from. Maybe anything above 100 even.
Yeah, you would start like saying, yeah. Maybe you'd call me.
Yeah, probably.
What do I do? You know, I think that there's this, you know, if it's 105, okay, that's too hot. Got to be some problems there. You could have a seizure. If it's 99, just suck it up a little bit. But it seems as if there's this middle ground there, in which perhaps, you know, calling a friend, calling a doctor, particularly someone who's healthcare experience would certainly be appropriate. Also, if you get a fever and you got a stiff neck, what would you think about that?
Had that happen, and it's not good. Right, go to the doctor.
Yeah, because you worry about meningitis. So again, what are the other symptoms that you have despite the fever? You could have a high fever and actually have no other symptoms. That may be okay. High fever, burning when it urinates, better go see a doctor. It could be in your bloodstream. Great question. Laura, what's our next house call?
My allergies seem to be worse this year than they ever have been. Do you recommend nose spray for seasonal allergies?
Well, you know, boy, allergies are such a pervasive problem. You know, I don't think I had allergies until I moved to North Carolina. Do you ever get allergies?
I feel like mean saying this, but I've never had them.
Okay, we're going to take all of our allergies. Laura, you ever get allergies?
I have allergies to grass pollens.
Okay.
Oh, well, there you go. Mm-hmm. That's going to come up a lot.
Yep.
And I think I have allergy to, like, people who aren't very nice to me. But we're going to pass all our allergies over to Laura so she can be a little more empathetic here. But we do know, and you see people over in the hospital and the clinics who have significant allergies, and you see people who smoke, and you know that smoking probably leads to sinus problems for a lot of people, and they can have real problems with their sinuses.
Yeah, it sounds like no fun to me, because being outside this time of year is what I want to be doing.
So the question here is, do we recommend some nose spray? And the short answer is that there are lots of things that can really be helpful to patients in terms of the nose sprays. We know about the medicines you can take by mouth, whether oral antihistamines or these other oral medications that can kind of inhibit or prevent these things from happening. There are some nasal sprays that can be used. There are a couple prescription ones called, I think, Patanol and Astapro. But you have to get these by prescription by going to see your doctor. You can get Flonase, which people have heard of, which is a generic steroid that you can actually get over the counter without a prescription. You can also get it by a prescription. A little confusing there, perhaps whatever's cheaper for you. And you can get a combination of these steroids and these antihistamines there. So those are all really good things to take. You can also get something called Cromolyn, which is available over the counter, which works by a different mechanism. These are all things that can be done. One thing you shouldn't do. Have you ever heard of something you shouldn't do? You ever hear people say, don't take that Sudafed for too long, or don't take that pseudoephedrine, you know, the pseudoephedrine that's in those, some of those sprays that, you know, you get immediate relief, and but then like 5-6 hours later, you get congested again.
Oh, I haven't heard of that.
You haven't seen that? Well, they say don't take that for more than a day or two. And the reason is you get this rebound. Use it for 2 or 3 days. It works, and then it comes back. It works, and it comes back. And then you get addicted to that because there's also cocaine-like receptors in the nose. I know. This is kind of like getting a little out there. Stay with me for a second. So you wouldn't want to do that because you can get very easily addicted to those nose sprays. So that's a kind of a 101 for some of these issues. Good question, though. Laura? What's our very next house call?
I've been listening to your show, and I'm curious. What's the one thing you wish your patients knew that they likely don't know?
Okay, Laura, we have not compared notes here. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I don't know what you're going to say. You don't know what I'm going to say.
It would be funny if we said the same thing.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, what is your piece of advice, and why is it your piece of advice?
My piece of advice is that there is good treatment out there for mental health issues like anxiety, like depression, like, you know, having issues with drinking, alcohol, opiates, all those sorts of things. There is actually good treatment. I think in most circles that I run in, there's kind of a belief that somehow there's nothing that works for those issues, or there's just a lot of shame wrapped up in those types of issues, and people don't end up seeking help. And there are really good treatments, counseling, there's medications, things that help with cravings. And that would be my advice, would be to go get some help if you're having issues.
I think that's such a great piece of advice because oftentimes we, you know, think, oh, there's nothing to be done. And I remember when I started medical school, you know, back in the 1800s, there perhaps didn't seem to be as much, particularly things like alcohol. And then now you look in the guidelines and you find multiple medications that are actually available to help people. We are 7 medications alone to help people with nicotine addiction. There are medications available to help people with opiate addiction.
Exactly.
And that don't even include all the behavioral strategies. People think, oh, those behavioral strategies are soft. You don't believe that, do you?
No. But both is good. A combination is kind of the ideal approach. And insurance usually covers it. And there are options if you don't have insurance. So well, go talk to your doctor or talk to somebody you trust about that.
You know what my one is? Trust your instincts. As a patient, I think it's too often you come in the doctor's office and you feel kind of silly. You know, I had the symptom yesterday, but I don't have it today, and I feel kind of stupid coming. Or, you know, I'm not so certain. I don't tell you how many times I've asked a patient, you know, who ends up telling me I was short of breath. You know, I said, well, why didn't you tell me about it? Well, you didn't ask about it. Or I thought it was silly. I would say trust your instincts. If you believe something's not right, keep talking with the doctor or a different doctor or coming back and finding out and pressing for it. Because too often, that's the only way to figure out something that's more difficult. If it's obvious, it's easy to figure out. But when it's more difficult, it takes more persistence.
It's really good advice.
What's our last house call?
Our listener has several guests coming in town over the next few months and asks, how can they make healthier choices when they are going out to eat a lot with these guests?
I oftentimes go looking on TripAdvisor when I'm looking into a new city. You know, if you looked up in Chapel Hill, you know it's like number one?
What's that?
Sunrise biscuit. I like my biscuits as much as anyone. Don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating against any biscuit places, and I go there, you know, pretty regularly. But I don't know, you know, if you wanted to eat healthier, would you necessarily take someone by the biscuit place?
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I get this question a lot, and we talk about it a lot in our groups that we do for weight management and in individual counseling too. One thing would be if you can look up the menu beforehand, which you almost always can do that, then you can get a sense of what you're going to order. Better to make decisions about what you want to get when you're not hungry. When you're hungry, decision-making gets totally clouded. And then, you know, avoiding fried foods if you're trying to make a healthier choice is always a good option. And then I talk about kind of the 3 vices, I guess. So if you're going to a typical American restaurant, you've got kind of your burger or some sort of sandwich plus fries plus dessert, and you can really only ever have 2. That's my suggestion.
Were you with me last time when I went out to eat? How did you know? No, this is a real issue. I thought you were going to say ice cream because I could have the ice cream for
my
appetizer main and then the dessert. Yeah. I like to say, look to places that offers lots of salads because particularly when you're going out to eat a lot. I mean, I travel a lot and I'm at meetings a lot and you're going out to eat And even though I don't eat meat, it's still very easy to eat things that aren't very healthy. So I'm always looking to try to increase my salads when I'm going out to eat, because mm-hmm. you can do a lot of things. You can have salads with a fish on it or grilled chicken that are, mm-hmm. can actually be really quite healthy, lower your overall calorie count.
Yeah, and if you are really craving the burger or the fries, have one, not both, and opt for maybe a side salad to get you some of those nutrients too.
Great advice. Well, that'll conclude the House Call section of our show today, and we want to thank all of you for listening to Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you, and you can send anything you want to send. You can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we'll read it on the show and give our thoughts. You can visit online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Adam Jacks, and our great co-host, Laurel Sisler. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Laurel Sisler.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Presented by UNC Family Medicine.